The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member. And we don't mean your Aunt Dolores.
You stink!
The TNT Shop has it all. At TNTRadio.live. Investigating and reporting on government corruption and overreach, you're listening to Scott Wheeler and Through the Looking Glass on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. And there's a lot happening. A lot has happened this week, including some more of Joe Biden's economic lies, which we'll cover here in just a minute. But first, this week, an article in the New York Times came out about the Durham report. Of course, John Durham, the special prosecutor who was appointed by former Attorney General William Barr to investigate the Russia collusion hoax. Actually, I don't even want to call it a hoax. It wasn't a hoax. It was a political invention by the Hillary Clinton campaign. And it dominated all 4 years of the Trump campaign. Now, let me go on record and say, in October of 2016, I reported in Forbes magazine that it had no substance whatsoever, that it was impossible that Vladimir Putin wanted Donald Trump to win the election because for 4 years, as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton genuflected to Putin constantly. And for 8 years, Obama did, including after he invaded Crimea. Obama gave Putin everything he wanted, including pulling two missile sites out of new allies Poland and the Czech Republic against their will. And because Putin wanted them out, they had the reset right after Putin invaded Georgia. They had Obama decontrolled missile technology, high-tech missile technology for Russia, for their use, our technology. And in 2010, when the FBI swept up 10 Russian agents, spies, 10 Russian spies that were operating in a sleeper cell that had connections to both Clinton and Obama. Obama returned the spies before the FBI could even interrogate them about what they knew, who they had talked to. These spies had been in place for years in the United States. They were sent back to a hero's welcome in Moscow for virtually nothing in return, and Clinton went out and bragged about it. Now you have the end of the Durham investigation. It's winding down. He's going to issue some kind of report probably in the next 2 to 3 weeks. And the New York Times is saying he found nothing because nothing actually happened. Well, something did happen. Russia interfered in the 2012 election. And guess who they supported in that election? It's not hard. You saw the videotape. We've all seen this videotape of Barack Obama talking to Dmitry Medvedev, telling him, tell Vlad I'll be more flexible after my election. I can compromise on all these things, missile defense, all these things, he said. But I need to get past this election, meaning he had to lie to the American people about being tough on Russia before he got reelected. And he knew at that time that Russia was interfering in the 2012 election. Curious, isn't it? Nobody has any interest in this. I pointed it out. I've reported it myself multiple times. We know that Russia interfered in the 2012 election because Obama's own DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, James Clapper, told Congress under oath that he did. There was no interest. So I've said this before too, if every lie the Democrat Party made up about Trump and Russia collusion, and this isn't a defense of Trump, he handled this scandal so poorly. I literally wrote the plan for how to defeat it, how to make it a public issue, and how to, in Forbes, before he was even elected. But he, instead of grabbing that with both hands, he went around and said, oh, it's a witch hunt, and Russia, 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 which made him look like he might be guilty, even though he wasn't. He acted guilty. It was just so stupid, his behavior and all this. But for the media, who knew better, to run around and report this as though there was evidence that was true, if every lie the Democrats had said about Trump were true, it pales by comparison for what Obama's relation with Putin was. And the evidence for that is right out in the open. Clear and present evidence right in our faces. He did all of these things. I listed almost all of them in the Forbes article. And no one paid any attention. And here we are, 6 years later now, still lamenting what went wrong. And because Durham couldn't get a conviction because, and I'll say it, a corrupt judge, I won't reveal my sources, but I'll tell you, a corrupt judge in the Kevin Kleinsmith case and in the Michael Sussman case, the two people that Kleinsmith pleaded guilty to, he was a lawyer for the FBI, pleaded guilty to falsifying a document that implicated Carter Page, who was a CIA asset at the time. And he changed the CIA's warning to the FBI to say that Carter Page wasn't a CIA asset, when he was, and the CIA said twice, warned Kleinsmith, watch it. He's one of ours. Watch out. Don't do it. So they jeopardized Carter Page's life while he's working deep cover for the CIA in order to get Trump. And Kleinsmith got a slap on the wrist by an Obama-appointed judge. Then later, Michael Sussman was found guilty by a D.C. jury because, why? Because, one of the jurors said, lying to the FBI is not the worst problem we have in this country. Well, try telling that to Michael Flynn, General Flynn, who was ruined because they forced him to plead guilty to supposedly misleading the FBI, even though the FBI said he didn't mislead him. So now we're here in this, we have this problem with a corrupted jury pool because the Democrats lie incessantly. And you have many of these trials are taking place, were taking place in Washington, D.C., where you have a 92% Democrat. Washington, D.C., votes 92% Democrat. And when Obama was on the ballot, it was 94% Democrat. That's the jury pool for these cases. And then you have presiding over them corrupt Democrat-appointed judges who suppress evidence, won't allow evidence. This is what happened. And you will not see justice. And I wouldn't believe a word in the New York Times article this week that says there was nothing there. It was actually Trump was guilty of some stuff or investigated for some things. He was investigated thoroughly, and they couldn't get anything on him. Even with people willing to lie, witnesses willing to lie, they couldn't get him on Russia collusion because it didn't exist. Russia wanted Clinton, and they actually went to great lengths to help it look like they were colluding with Trump. We'll get into that once the Durham report is out. We'll cover that right now, this week. And look, we've all grown used to Joe Biden telling whopper economic lies. Well, whoppers about everything, literally everything. We're going to be joined shortly by noted economist Darren Brady Nelson. But just to cover some of Biden's noted lies, Let me direct you to Ann Coulter column where she lists the Biden lies. In a space of 3 days last fall, Coulter writes, President Joe Biden claimed to be Puerto Rican, practiced Judaism, and to have lost his house in a natural disaster. All lies. He said, celebrating Jewish New Year at the White House on September 30th, he told Jewish leaders, I probably went to shul more than many of you did. You all think I'm kidding. No, I did. I'd go to services on Saturday and on Sunday, adding, you'll think I'm kidding. I'm not. You know, those are one of, Biden has a tell. You can tell when he's lying because he'll say, you think I'm kidding? I'm not. No, you don't believe me, do you? You think I'm kidding? That's his tell. That's one of his many tells. Virtually everything he says is untrue in some form or another. So then he claimed to be Puerto Rican. He claimed, many times that he said he had been to the Tree of Life congregation in Pittsburgh. He said he went to the Tree of Life synagogue, which the synagogue said he never visited. In the South Carolina primary, Biden claimed he had many, many, many times, I had the great honor of being arrested on the streets of Soweto trying to get to see Nelson Mandela. Never happened. Biden was never arrested in South Africa. Sadly, Biden clinched the presidential nomination in 2020. Democrats locked him in the basement until election year. And so it is impossible to know all the lies that he would have told had he been out running his mouth on the campaign trail. But this week, he says economic growth is up. Talking in Springfield, Virginia, he said on the 26th. Economic growth is up, stronger than experts expected at 2.9%. We're growing. Jobs are the highest in America, I'm quoting directly, so I'm not stuttering, number in the highest in American history. That's what he said. Jobs are the highest in America, number in the highest in American history. And wages are up, and they're growing faster than inflation. Now, how many lies? There's material lies, actual lies, and then there are twisting and contorting in all of those statements. Over the past 6 months, Biden said, inflation has gone down every month, and God willing, will continue to do that. Well, again, there's actual lies, technical lies, and manipulations in that statement. Manufacturing jobs continue to go up, stronger than any time in the past 40 years. Now, in order to understand this, we brought in part of the problem we have right now in the United States is, and most are timid about bringing this up, but the Wall Street Journal hints at it today. In the weekend edition of the Wall Street Journal, they hint consumers cut back spending in latest sign of a slowdown. We'll get back to Biden's statements on the economy in a moment with our expert witness, Darren Brady Nelson. But right now, the Wall Street Journal said U.S. households turned cautious at the end of the year, cutting spending during the holiday shopping season and increasing savings, adding to signs of an economic slowdown. Is that where we're heading? It's very possible. The Wall Street Journal said the pullback in spending came as inflation cooled, giving consumers some relief. It did cool in some areas, in the energy sector. Households spent less on goods as prices fell for gasoline and other energy products, but they increased spending on services where prices climbed. So it was a trade-off. There was no real economic advantage here. And we'll take a short time out right now. When we come back, we'll bring in Darren Brady Nelson, and we'll start unpacking the Biden statements. We'll ask Mr. Nelson about the economic status right now, and we'll ask him about out-of-control government spending and how this is going to affect the economy and a potential recession and possibly worse. We'll take a break. This is Through the Looking Glass on TNT Radio.
You should hear what Timothy Shea is talking about.
The left are of Satan. Literally, all they do is they tear down, destroy. Look at anything they've quote-unquote built. It's never been built back better. It's always been worse. And one of my theses is that this whole COVID scamdemic is designed to divide us. Public support for doctors has plunged by double digits between the transgender mutilation surgeries, between the COVID jabs. Is that by design?
Absolutely, this is by design. There's actually that old adage, divide and conquer, right? If you want to conquer the masses, you have to divide them. Well, the basic structures of our entire American foundation has been, number one, the family, and then probably church, and then organizations beyond that. And they have done a phenomenal job at creating division in all of those categories.
Timothy Shea on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702 or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Far-left Brazilian Supreme Court orders banks to block funds of businessmen who supported the protesters and mass democracy rallies. Sounds like Canada, doesn't it?
The federal government has invoked the Emergencies Act.
Today's News Talk,
TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Through the Looking Glass on TNT Radio. I'm Scott Wheeler from Washington, D.C., broadcasting. And right now, going into the break, we were talking about the Biden lies about the economy. Now, let me bring in our expert witness today. Darren Brady Nelson is an Austrian school economist and liberty evangelon, as well as a C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton style Christian. He is currently the chief economist and a longtime policy advisor to the Heartland Institute of Chicago. He is also a regular commentator in traditional and online Australian and American media. Mr. Brady Nelson, welcome to Through the Looking Glass. It's good to have you back with us.
Thank you. Good to be back.
And let me start with the Biden statement on the 26th. Economic growth is up, stronger than experts expected at 2.9%. We're growing. Jobs are the highest, and now the jobs in America are highest in number in history is an easy one because there's more people and the economy grows every year. Of course, there's more people working, but also he says wages are up and they're growing faster than inflation. The Wall Street Journal debunked that today, in fact. What do you say about Biden's assessment of the U.S. economy right now? Is he in the ballpark? Is he fudging a little bit? Or is he just flat out distorting the facts? would you say?
Look, I mean, he's picking a couple of official statistics that, yes, that is kind of accurate, if you like. You hit the nail on the head with one of them. You know, the population growth can drive a lot of that. And obviously, with you know, and then add in you know, a lot of illegal immigration that's jacking up the numbers. You know, and obviously the Democrats and other like-minded people in D.C. you know, bend over backwards to count people in these sort of statistics that they shouldn't be counting. So yeah, population growth is some of that. What he doesn't get into is kind of the statistics that kind of show that things are not looking so great. You kind of alluded to it. Well, two of them, you know, inflation is still a big problem just because inflation has slightly slowed from its outrageous levels is not that impressive. You know, I wouldn't be crowing about that. And government spending, you know, because government spending is kind of one of the key indicators to a whole bunch of different other economic indicators. So, you know, government spending is driving, obviously, any push for getting increased taxes, because obviously they want to, you know, try to cover as much of, you know, that spending with taxes as they can. Then you also look to things like, you know, how much borrowing, because obviously they have to borrow the gap between, you know, revenue and expenditures. And then again, back to inflation, which ultimately you have to look beyond things like the consumer price index, which, you know, is an indicator of, you know, a lot of the prices in the economy. But inflation at the end of the day is inflation of the money supply. And, you know, that's slowed down again a little bit because the Federal Reserve knows that, you know, the party can't go on forever. That's where you have to really look at. He's kind of just holding on to a couple statistics that are, you know, still holding on. But, you know, the indications are that, you know, we're at least heading for a recession. And like a real one, not just the statistical one we had, you know, last year with the two quarters of negative growth. I think something far worse is coming our way, and possibly stagflation, because even though the Federal Reserve's taken, you know, some action on trying to slow down the money supply growth and interest rates, and by raising interest rates, the indicators are just not looking good. You know, the whole Biden policies have been just like very anti-economic growth, anti-business, anti-consumer.
So when you say stagflation, you mean the stagnant growth of the economy while inflation continues to rise, creating a dynamic that we haven't seen in full force since the late 70s, right?
Yeah, that's it, essentially. Yeah, stagflation, where you get inflation and just either, you know, negative economic growth, or at least kind of really barely growing. So, you know, if you statistically keep on growing, but it's at some anemic level, that's not good. And that's the sort of thing we saw in the 1970s, you know, particularly under Carter. But, you know, to be fair, it was a bipartisan effort, you know, with Ford as well. You know, because obviously, I'm sure you've criticized the bad Republicans, because there's plenty of them, sadly. And sadly, also, in the U.S., not to mention Australia, since we're on an Australian radio show.
Should we ask the audience, do I ever criticize Republicans?
I'm sure you have.
I refer to the two parties in the U.S. as the corrupt party and the stupid party. Republicans are the stupid party. But yeah, I do criticize them frequently for these very things. They allow Democrats to take them hostage for bad policy that creates these, well, just as you referred to, stagflation. And it's true. They are weak and pathetic. And oftentimes in the political business, the only reason the Republicans are not as corrupt as the Democrats is because the Democrat Party run media holds them accountable for corruption for the most part, unless they are players. Unless they are the controlled opposition for the Democrat Party, and then they'll throw them a bone once in a while. But for the most part, Republicans will be pursued like a dog chasing a car for a parking violation while massive corruption exists in the Democrat Party and no one will say a word about it or report on it, even as they're condemning Martha Stewart for insider trading for a few thousand bucks and allowing the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, to make millions doing it. But anyway, back to the central point. Yes, you're absolutely right. It's not entirely a Democrat problem. It's actually a Washington problem because no one will deal with it. They talk about dealing with it. Every election cycle, it seems, you have people freshly coming in and to office like they're going to take on the fix the establishment. All we have to do is cut spending, which is the your paper we're going to get to in a minute. You talk about slashing spending, but they all say all we have to do is cut spending, like it's easy to do, and yet no one can ever do it, right?
Yeah, well, look, the other term that I've heard bandied around is the uni party, which is describing obviously the Washington, permanent Washington, essentially. There's a number of things they seem to agree on. They seem to agree on, kind of like fairly endless wars, regardless of the merits of the particular war. And also two other things that is less known, and again, we touched on it a little bit earlier, is and again, you'll see this in Australia, in permanent Canberra, if you like, that they like population growth, particularly immigration population growth, because they're not really getting much out of birth rates. So that just jacks up economic numbers like GDP and like labor. You can get more jobs because they're just a growing population. The other thing they like is, endless growth of the money supply, like particularly high levels. Because again, that's just kind of lazy. You get, GDP again gets jacked up by both those figures, because GDP is basically a price times quantity statistic. So the price gets jacked up by inflating the money supply, and the quantity gets jacked up by population. I mean, there's other factors as well, but that's just like easy wins. And the population, politicians, as you pointed out, like the Democrat Party is, on a totally different level of corruption, slash laziness, slash incompetence than the GOP is. So they just love those two things happening. It's just easy wins that they can point to and take credit, when things are going well. Then, of course, when they go badly, they go, oh, it's mysterious forces or obviously more recently, they'll blame Russia for everything, that's bad in the economy, which is, Russia has a strong influence on, through energy prices on Europe, although its effect on world energy isn't quite as significant, certainly not in North America, with the U.S. and Canada, its effect is pretty minimal. So they're taking, the classic politician excuses and taking them to new levels, so it's nothing new for politicians to lie about the economy. I've been doing this, for 25 plus years and seeing politicians constantly lie about the economy. But yeah, I mean, Biden's really taken it to kind of like new heights.
We're speaking with Darren Brady Nelson, a trained economist and who subscribes to the Austrian economic theory. And we were talking about the possibility of a recession. What parts of the economy are likely to be affected by a recession, this kind of recession that's been created by a bunch of outlier factors, such as the pandemic, et cetera?
Look, I mean, the crashes tend to they tend to happen first in the completely bubble areas. Like classically, real estate tends to be, kind of like the money supply. Wall Street and property will be kind of the first things that will like really tank first before they start spreading.
Similar to 2008, 2009. And in the late 90s, we had the tech bubble burst, which triggered a recession.
But then other times, mining has sometimes been an indicator. But the two classics since at least the great crash, in 1929, has been property and Wall Street, equities, But we might see some other places where some of the bubbles have popped up more recently. You mentioned the .com that was kind of had its characteristics that were slightly different. I mean, technology in general is a bit of a bubble. Another one by an Austrian school economist, he keeps track of the amount of ridiculous record-breaking skyrise buildings around the world. That's like been the skyscraper index. That's a pretty good indicator. When you see them stopping to build a new record-setting skyscraper, that's often a pretty good indicator that the crash is coming.
When they stop building a skyscraper.
Yeah, well, they'll often be in the middle of it or, you know, two-thirds through, and then they go, the banks, you know, the people who lent them money on either in equity markets or in debt markets start going, the numbers aren't adding up. You better put this thing on hold.
And so that is another indicator, because they don't, when a construction company is building a skyscraper for a business, they don't get all the money at once. It comes in chunks. The bank releases funds based on the development of the project and its potential for success. And so you're saying if the money starts to dry up, the process of building declines and in some cases just stops abruptly. Have you checked that index, the so-called skyscraper index, recently to see if there's a trend?
I haven't recently, but it's one that's held up pretty well. I mean, the person who developed it is Mark Thornton. He's a professor of economics at the Mises Institute. And he doesn't claim that this is like some, he just says that, look, there's a logic behind why it is statistically is often, you know, quite a useful indicator. He's not suggesting that it's sort of like an economic law. But it, because these skyscrapers in particular, I'm not talking about just any old skyscrapers, although you could look to that more broadly, but it's these kind of vanity ones where, you know, around the world, there's these people trying to build the tallest one, you know, to beat the previous tallest one, right? So they're real vanity projects. So it's not surprising that this sort of thing would be the first thing that, you know, the carpet would be taken from, you know, like the banks would go, wait a second, all right, you know, this looked good at one stage, but, you know, we just can't support this one at the moment. We're going to have to wait till, the recession comes and leaves, and then we get back onto a stronger footing so that we can afford this vanity project.
Right now we have indicators that we've never had before. For example, Amazon, the largest corporation in the world, just laid off, I think it was 14,000 or so.
Yeah.
Cut back, yep. 14,000. What would you read into that? What would that indicate?
It doesn't surprise me, because a lot of these, I mean, one of the things you need to look to is, besides kind of the vanity projects, is you have to also look at, money tends to flow to these cartelized industries, if you like. I wouldn't go so far to say monopoly, but, you know, big tech. Amazon pretty much is approaching, in some respects, a bit of a monopoly in its particular market. So when times are like good and there's a bit of a bubble going, you'd expect even more money to flow to these sorts of companies like an Amazon, particularly as, you know, Elon Musk showed in the technology companies, just how potentially bloated they are with a whole bunch of useless sort of like middle management and overheads, just like at Twitter, you know, like as he famously, or if you like infamously, got rid of 80% of the staff. And not only did they survive, like their business carried on, it actually started to do better. Now, it doesn't suggest that Amazon has 80% useless staff, but there's a pretty good chance that it's quite bloated, though. And I think, you know, them laying off a whole bunch of people would be, you know, certainly one of the kind of micro indicators to look at, besides kind of the larger macro indicators. And again, there's actually a lot of art to this. You know, battling, you know, which indicator is going to tell you for sure a recession's coming. I would look at kind of more of the, you know, as we discussed some kind of some of the classical indicators of, you know, what's happening to the money supply, what's happening to CPI, government spending. Those are some better macro indicators. That they won't tell you the exact timing, because look, if people knew the exact timing, you know, you could really, you know, make a killing, I suppose, shorting things, or, you know, you could also keep on investing but then pull out at the right time. No one knows that. And anybody who claims that, they probably just got lucky in hindsight. So you really have to look at a whole bunch of indicators and use kind of also qualitative judgment. But to make a long story short, yeah, I think, you know, what's happening at Amazon is certainly one of those indicators that tell you that something's coming and probably coming soonish.
We're speaking with Darren Brady Nelson, an economist. We're going to coming up on a break. And when we get back, Mr. Brady Nelson has written a report entitled Make America Great Again. Again, don't just cut taxes, slash spending. We'll get into that right after we take a short time out. You're listening to TNT Radio's Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler from Washington, D.C.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Remember back in 2021 when Georgia passed new voting regulations into law? The media and the left went certifiably nuts, claiming without any evidence that the changes were targeting the African-American community and would make it almost impossible for many of them to cast a vote in that state. Voter suppression, they cried. It was Jim Crow, they claimed. And Major League Baseball was so offended that they moved the All-Star game, which was slated to be played in Atlanta that summer. Even record turnout during the 2022 midterms didn't stop the left from repeating false claims about the state of Georgia's election procedures. But a funny thing has happened. The University of Georgia has conducted a poll asking Georgia voters about their voting experiences in 2022. Guess what? 0% of blacks reported a poor experience. In fact, 72%, meanwhile, said that they had an excellent experience, the same as white voters. So, folks, this should finally put to rest that false talking point constantly spewed by the left in order to push their false narrative of black voters under attack in Georgia. Except it won't. In fact, the false claims will only get worse. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
In times of fear, World Vision is there for the most vulnerable. For the last 70 years, we've been standing with kids and families through natural disasters, war, and disease, delivering life-saving aid and helping rebuild lives. And with every act of courage, faith, and love, we do more than just stop the spread of fear. We replace it with hope. Learn more at worldvision.org.
From national security to global corruption, you're with Scott Wheeler and Through the Looking Glass on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Our expert witness today, Darren Brady Nelson, is a master economist from the Austrian School of Economics mindset, and he has written a paper we will discuss here in just a second. Right now, just this weekend, the Wall Street Journal is reporting the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, the Federal Reserve's preferred gauge of inflation, rose 5% in December from a year ago after increasing 5.5% in November. This price index would indicate that the false claim that Biden is making about the inflation dropping because fuel prices have dropped because he released the oil from the strategic oil reserves, released, flooded the market, put pressure on oil producing nations. So the fuel costs have come down a little bit. But the reality is the Federal Reserve's preferred gauge of inflation actually rose 5%. That's the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index. Is this more evidence, Mr. Nelson, of Biden being disingenuous with the American people?
Yeah, I wish I had it at my fingertips. So I did do a little bit of analysis of, you know, sort of the potential impact of you know, what was released from the strategic reserve. But I mean, the upshot is it's minuscule. I mean, it is like minuscule compared to, you know, sort of the overall supply in the of market supply in the U.S. It's really, you know, to extend it had some sort of psychological impact briefly, maybe. Really, the strategic reserve, putting its merits aside, it is just too small to have any great effect on the overall U.S. Energy economy.
In the long run, of course, he was using it for
not even in the short run. It's minuscule. It is so minuscule. You know, you'd be talking about maybe the immediate run. It might have some sort of impact. I don't know its whole history. I could see the value of it.
But it's coming back up again. The prices, gas prices are coming back up again. They're not where they were last summer, but they're up.
Yeah. The key there is putting aside the overall consumer price index, CPI. Energy is a significant, there's a lot of stuff that goes into the CPI. And the strategic oil reserves impact on oil, which is just one aspect of energy, we're talking minuscule, minuscule, minuscule. There'd be really next to no impact whatsoever. The big problem is, you know, the Biden administration's like war on fossil fuels, for lack of a better term. Basically, they've really heavily restricted the supply of energy in this country. And that's what's the main thing that's driving up prices. It's not the Russian war. That certainly has a huge impact on, again, you know, energy prices in Europe. Yeah, definitely. Not in the U.S. The U.S. is basically a self-inflicted shooting yourself in the foot sort of issue, a policy of just heavily restricting the production of oil and gas and other sort of fossil fuel energies in the U.S. That is by far the main reason why.
And then blaming the war, Russia, for the price increase after their actual policy caused the gas shortages.
Yeah, and you can see statistically, and you can easily go see the official statistics. This was a problem well before the Russian war anyway. It's pretty laughable to blame the Russian war. Now, if you're, like I said, if you're Germany, yes, it has an impact in Germany and Europe, definitely, but not in the U.S. No, that's a self-inflicted policy.
Quoting from your paper here, the Biden administration has had an increase in something, and that is the increased federal government spending by a record $3.4 trillion since January 2021. That includes such signature bills as the American Rescue Plan Act of $1.8 trillion, Build Back Better Act $1.7 trillion, and Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act of $764.9 billion. That is a lot of money, a record expenditures by the U.S. government at a time we're experiencing inflation and a very, if nothing else, tender economy. What was your point in your paper, the federal government spending out of control and unsustainable? What are your dire predictions from this?
Well, I mean, in a nutshell, you know, even over time when we've had sort of good tax reforms, like, you know, obviously, most recently during the Trump administration, those were good tax reforms. And obviously, you really then have to go back to the Reagan administration for other sort of good tax reforms. One thing that even under, you know, sort of good Republican administrations, they'll tackle tax, and that's great. But you really have to ultimately tackle spending, because the spending is driving things. Like I mentioned before, it's driving the tax, you know, pressure to put up the taxes. It's driving the pressure to borrow more money, or conversely, not to reduce, you know, to reduce your debt. And then it's ultimately driving, maybe not the only driver, but it's a huge driver for cranking up the money supply, which is the thing that ultimately is inflation. Inflation ultimately is jacking up the money supply, which then impacts all prices throughout the economy. They don't sort of do it uniformly. It will create various bubbles around the economy. So it also, a lot of people don't know this, you know, even if people kind of know that inflation is really ultimately due to the money supply being jacked up, they don't realize that it's also the business cycle. The business cycle isn't really driven by businesses. It's actually driven by government money supply, which is the Federal Reserve in partnership with the U.S. Treasury, ultimately. So that also creates the boom-bust cycle, which we don't really need to have in an economy. And then, you know, that causes all sorts of bad things as well. So it's a double whammy. It's actually more than a double whammy, but it's at least a kind of double whammy to just normal households and particularly small and medium-sized businesses. Big business, as you've noticed, can tend to, not all big business, but a lot of them can ride this out. You know, like Amazon can just fire a bunch of people, ride it out. Whereas, you know, a medium and small size business, if they have to get rid of a whole bunch of people, that means they might not be able to do their business anymore. And so they may not survive. So it's sadly, you know, we've also seen the wokeness and all that. It's just been made clear in the 2020s under the Biden administration, just the synergy between crony big business, crony big labor, crony big banks, and a whole bunch of other things, to the detriment of medium and small sized businesses and just average families in America.
Now, you talk about the debt and printing money, and the national debt, I think, is now $30 trillion. And at what point will printing money cause creditors to no longer extend credit to the United States? And what will happen as a result of that? Is that possible? Could it happen?
Yeah, look at it, you know. I bet you've talked about this on your show at times, where like China and Russia and some other countries, the Saudis are trying to move away from the U.S. dollar. Now, there'll be obviously mixed motives, particularly for China. Well, it's for all of them, actually, there's mixed motives. But there is an economic motive. And one is, you know, the U.S. as a reserve currency, you know, the U.S., the Federal Reserve and the Treasury and other sort of government forces in the U.S. have just been abusing it. They've been abusing, you know, having the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency. So basically, they can kind of transfer the pain, you know, by, you know, printing more and more and more money. It doesn't directly hurt the U.S. economy quite as directly because it's the world's reserve currency, but it certainly can hurt, you know, sort of our debtors in China and other places. So they're actively looking to replace the U.S. as the reserve currency. Now, partly it's for sensible reasons, the economic reasons that I just talked about, but it's also for, you know, more nefarious, obviously, strategic reasons as well. You know, with China obviously trying to replace the U.S. as the number one, you know, power in the world as well.
World superpower. Yeah. What would happen? What would happen? This is kind of an off-the-wall question for an economist, but what would happen if the United States took I think we owe China $3 trillion in debt now. What if the United States said, calculated out the damage to the U.S. economy by China's lab leak at the Wuhan lab and said, you owe us, we're erasing the $3 trillion we owe you, and you owe us an additional $2 trillion or $3 trillion, whatever the amount is of damage they actually did to the U.S. economy. What would happen, do you think, in that circumstance? We just wiped off the debt we owed them and told them they owed us more money because of the financial damage, and have a legitimate calculation of the damage.
Yeah, look, that's a hard one. I'm not sure, but I think that's something worth investigating. I would like to see, you know, a good think tank or whoever kind of do that calculus, basically, and to look further, to go like, what it would look like in terms of the costs and benefits, particularly to the U.S. economy, but also to, you know, particularly our allies in the world economy, to, you know, treat China like we treated the Soviet Union, you know, under the Reagan administration, you know, with an actual plan that we're basically going to bring down the Soviet Union as it's currently configured. Because when you're dealing with China, it's not like you're dealing, you know, when you're trading with China, you're not really trading with a whole bunch of just private citizens or private corporations, which I'd be happy. You know, I'm you know, for free trade. But when you're dealing with China, you're not, that is not free trade. To any significant player that you're trading with is essentially either directly a government entity or, you know, de facto government entity. And everything thus is under the rubric of China's effort to become the number one power, and not just to displace the U.S., but to dominate the world as, you know, as, I mean, I guess they're nominally communist, but they're really moved to more of sort of a fascist style economy. And they behave like fascists as well, like the old school 1930s fascists.
That's an excellent point. Yeah, you're absolutely right. They have sort of converted from communism to fascism. That there's substantial differences, but their 16 character policy actually lays out how the military comes first and the economy is the government, and the government is the military, and the economy is the military. This sort of approach to governance, and you combine that with their objectives to be the world's lone superpower, replace the United States as the world's lone superpower. We have a dangerous set of circumstances in front of us, especially when we're looking at economic faltering in the not too distant future here. What do you say?
Yeah, look, the counter to this is, I guess, as China's moved, you know, they had kind of a period where they really did kind of, you know, at least compared to what they were, you know, liberalize markets to some extent in some regions and allowed people more freedoms, you know, to some extent, you know, particularly in the 90s, maybe through to maybe, you know, when the global financial crisis hit roughly right around then, maybe. But since then, they've been going backwards. So I guess the counter to that is the Chinese economy is nowhere near as good as, you know, its statistics portray, or, you know, the way a lot of big business and, you know, academics and State Department officials have fawned over it over the past 15 years. It's been actually kind of, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say going backwards, but it's been just, you know, starting to falter more and more, because a fascist economy, and certainly a communist economy, is just like a recipe for disaster, obviously, as the Soviets showed. But, you know, Germany and Italy, you know, the reason they pushed for war is because they were in economic trouble. I mean, they had a philosophy, obviously, of empire and domination and all that, but they were also, you know, they had a ticking time clock, you know, in terms of their economies. They were not looking so good. They needed war. They needed expansion because their economies weren't so good. And China's got the same thing going on, basically, which is why they've become more and more aggressive, because their economy isn't so good. And we've seen, you know, the internal strife, obviously, over COVID restrictions. But some of that, a lot of that internal strife is because the economy isn't so good. You know, people are feeling the heat. And so that's why China is looking for, you know, external expansion, plus, you know, like Argentina did with the Falklands, you know, distractions and all that. Oh, look, we have this common enemy over here and all that sort of thing. Or we're going to bring China glory. You know, don't worry that the economy is crud and we're making life miserable for you here. Look, you know, good times are coming once we have Taiwan.
That is, we're speaking with Darren Brady Nelson, an economist, and your paper, which is available at America First Policy Institute, Make America Great Again, Don't Just Cut Taxes / Spending. You go through a lot of detail in how this has to be done, and you show that there really, since 1970, really has been no... What they call a cut is the reduction in the increase of spending. In other words, if you're spending $100 million on the EPA per year now, and you say we're going to spend $120 million in 2 years, and then you reduce it to $115 million, they call that a cut. And it's not really a cut, as you point out in your paper. What has to be done? We got to wrap up here quickly, Mr. Brady Nelson. But can you say what has to be done in order to achieve a real cut?
Yeah, look, the thing you're referring to is a op-ed that hopefully will be coming out in the next week or two. But that in turn is based on a paper I just did for the Maine Policy Institute, looking at cutting the Maine budget. As you said, not just slowing the growth, but actually cutting it. So that's what we have to do. We can't just slow the growth of Leviathan. We actually have to start cutting Leviathan down to something that our founding fathers would recognize at some stage.
All right, Mr. Brady Nelson, thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you all for joining us on TNT's Through the Looking Glass. From Washington, I'm Scott Wheeler signing off.